Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, on the internet at hallel.info. How are the Bible's weekly Sabbath, sabbatical years, and the 50-year Jubilee actually linked? And what do they reveal about debt, poverty, land use, and Israel's modern history? In this deep-dive study of Leviticus, Deuteronomy, and Jeremiah, we connect Torah cycles to Mark Twain's haunting 1867 visit to Jerusalem, modern agriculture, and God's long memory. Discover why ignoring divine rest laws reshapes economies, communities, and even empires, and why generous release of debts may still change our future in ways we rarely expect.
Leviticus 25. So you notice that it obviously covers the Shemitah cycle, the seven-year cycle, as well as, of course, this isn't all the details as far as all the rules regarding the seven-year cycle. Nor does it cover all the rules for the Jubilee, but it does cover both of them. And I was curious, not that you have to answer the question, but think about it in your head here. You will notice that in Leviticus 25 is one of the few times where a holiday, or I guess an event, not really a holiday, because the Shemitah is not really holidays, but the event, the Torah explicitly makes effort to try to tie it to a Shabbat, meaning it tries hard to make the comparison between both of them. It's important why it does that. It does it for a reason. It has its reasoning, as opposed to other holy days, which it does not work so hard at doing. For example, even though we can intellectually see the 7 days of unleavened bread being like a 7 day week, we can count the numbers and in that the Shavuot, the count of the Omer, and then of course the 50th day is tied to Jubilee, the counting cycle. It doesn't go out of its way to describe and try to tie those together. We just intellectually figure it out, right? We're not fools. We can at least do math, basic math. In the case of this, however, there are a number of differences and some similarities. We'll cover a few of those today. Because these are relevant to our relationship with God, as far as how we interpret them, how we understand them, and how we apply them. So let's start out here. So in the case of the Shemitah cycle years, so on my board here, we obviously know our 7 days a week, right? Cycle years are done the exact same way, nothing very fancy about it. You have the various days. I have 6, 7. We understand whether it's a week or whether it is the years. The application essentially is the same. So you've got 7 years, sorry, 6 years which you would work, or 6 days which you would work. The seventh year is broken out as being its own independent time period, time slot, which you don't. Now, when we discuss Shabbat and its general rules, and there are a number of them regarding Shabbat, regarding rules as far as what we do and don't do, there are some things you will note as a theme for Shabbat. And the theme actually applies here as well. So, for example, the 6 days of the week, what are we doing during this, not Shabbat, but the 6 days? What do we do? We're working. We make this, build that, work for so-and-so, earn this money, buy this product, whatever it is, we're doing something. And those activities have a basic core foundation of the concept of gain. They're all designed to gain something. So these 6 days, we are gaining. We may focus on money, for example, which is obviously the easy in our culture to understand as money gains. But there's more than just money gains. There's also a position. Position gains. If you want to look at, for example, a politician for working, example, for position or authority. You also can work for things such as, obviously, food, clothing, and obviously shelter. There are various things we focus on for our days of the week, the 6 days of the week. We may actually gain or try to gain friendship, meaning work on relationships of activities, go have fun, whatever you want to do. They're all gaining something out of them. That is the really core principle of this activity during these 6 days a week. And there's more things you could put on here. I'm not going to try to do everything imaginable, but the idea is that these all these folks on gaining, and what are we gaining? It's gaining for who? It's not gaining for God. It's gaining for ourselves. So put over here, my gain. That's my goal. What I want was my family, friends, relatives. It's all about for myself. In the case of Shabbat, the intention is we don't, for example, buy and sell, right? Kind of hard to gain something when you're not buying or selling it. So there's no gain here. Specific gain. Shabbat's not designed for gain as far as my gain. Oh, sorry, what was that? Monetary. Right. So she's so asking, well, you can gain other things. Yeah, not monetary gain. There may be spiritual gain, but not monetary gain. The idea on Shabbat is that it is not for your wealth or for your desire or personal wants. The intent, however, is a day of rest. Well, imagine what we do, if you guys recall, what we do when we rest. Obviously, we're not working to gain things per se, not meaning a job or money or what we don't have or think of all the things we're missing out on, yada, yada, yada. Although that may be some more often for some people than others, what they're missing. But the idea is that you rest in not just your effort of work, but it rests in what doesn't, however, rest that much. I know this may be an esoteric question, so it's not so easy to answer. But for me personally, what doesn't rest is my relationship with God. Why does it not rest? Because that's my only focus. That's my objective. So we rest for most things except this one, relationship with God, we do not rest on. The idea being that we're spending our time focusing on what is He doing in our lives? What has He helped us with? My struggles, my issues at work, my things I want to get done or didn't get done last week. Oh no, I have to work harder on the next day because I didn't get it done by Friday afternoon. Yada, yada, yada. That time slot is designed for us to not focus to those tasks. And we understand that for the given week. And it's really not that hard. I know it sounds strange, but it's really not that difficult. Because one day, it's truly just one day. And that if you were, for example, let's say somebody has to work, they work all the time, right? If you called in sick that day, what would happen? You aren't going to go to work because you're sick. And the boss says, oh, bummer. We'll have to deal with somebody else to have somebody else fill your shift, your time shuttle, what happens to be. And those are the things that can happen. Now imagine applying that instead of for a day, but rather for a year. It's like, I think screeches a halt. A year? I would lose my job, right? Yes, Yosef. Yeah, my boss would say no. I do. It's much harder. But the concept is still the same. Now, it's not quite as bad as for a year versus Shabbat. It's far, far easier for Shabbat. So in the case of Shabbat, being one day is not that difficult. Yes, you may have to, for example, change jobs if necessary or make provisions for yourself or your family if necessary to accommodate for the day that you've missed, right? That can happen. But overall, the idea for a single year is or a single day is not that extreme. What gets far more extreme is for longer durations. Now, if you go on, for example, those of you who've done this, go for your vacation. You have vacation before, right? You've all done, most of you done vacations at some point in time in your lives. And those vacations may last, you know, a few days, a week, could be 2 weeks, how long happens to be. Those vacations you usually have to work up to. You're preparing for, let's pack our stuff, let's pre-get my life in order at work so that it can function while I'm not there as best we can. Although they may call you emergencies like do for me. the idea that things happen and you try to arrange it to where you can have your time off. That's the idea behind it. And you may last a few days. And in some cases, like many of us, when you come back from vacation to make up for lost time and fix all the stuff you work overtime to offset the fact that you were off. But that happens too. So the nature of vacations are the same concept, is that we're pre-planning what's going on to have this Shabbat or this vacation off. A vacation lasting a year is not so easy to do. It's a lot harder to do, actually. It's in extreme ways. We're going to talk about a little bit about that. Not much, but a little bit of time about that. So the idea, what I mentioned before on the gain and money and position, food, shelter, friendship, whatever it is, 6 days a week, the idea of gaining for work is still the same thing on the years. So erase some of this concept on these things I've written up here. The gain here for the six years is for food crops typically. Now, don't confuse this with all business. It's not every business would apply this way. This is for the food crops. The seventh Shemitah year is designed in its core for food. It does have some financial impacts too, but the core thing is food. So the gain here being discussed is 6 days, 6 years, sorry, are mostly crops. So crops here, that's its primary drive and focus is crops. Because the land is, the land would rest. You have your 6 years of growth, of planting, of plowing, yada, yada, yada. You get your crops during the time period. And then the seventh year, of course, the Shemitah cycle, you don't. And the idea is still the same principle in that our Shemitah cycle, we are not gaining any more food crops. You may have harvesting things out of the ground that grows naturally, but you're not going to be buying, selling those food items. You may have other things to buy and sell, but not those. Note, these are crops, and they do have debts, with debts shortly, as far as certain debts. However, in the case of other businesses, let's pretend you weren't in crops. Since you're here, you do dental work. So dental cleaning. dental work, any medical work, right? Yeah, this thing, you don't take a break for a year. I'm going to break brushing my teeth for a year. Will I pay for that? Definitely. So certain tasks that are not geared toward crops are not applied in the seventh year of rest. Because the land is not about, you know, you could argue, you know, my body, my health, my body rest, whatever. Reality is self-care doesn't apply. There are a number of things that also apply to other businesses. You may buy or sell products such as, furniture, beds you may buy or sell, or in Jeff's case, being a journalist. See, stop reporting for a year, Jeff, and what happens to all the politicians who no one reports on? Yeah, could you have a wreck of a country? No one have any clue what's happening. So certain businesses, politicians may love that, but that's not designed for journalism. So the certain things don't apply this way for gain. So the economy does not do a true shutdown, if that makes sense. It doesn't truly shut down. It has economic changes, but doesn't shut down. And this is the interesting thing, which I found interesting, maybe that most of you have not, but I find this interesting. So crops are mainly done by farmers. Farmers. Those of you who don't know farming, I don't, by the way. Farmers work a lot. They work all the time. The early morning, that's it. Oh, yeah. He said, nations would rejoice if journalists took a year off. Absolutely. Holy cow. So farmers are most of the crop growers. What happens when they're not working? What happens if they don't have to work? What are they going to do? You're like, they all blankly, I don't know. What do they do if they're not going to work? Well, they can't even touch the soil. The soil has to be left there. It has left fallow, left untouched. So they aren't working. Now, they may have animals. Because farmers aren't truly just crops. They actually have animals that live. They have to, feed them, to take care of them, whatever they're doing. They're still animals. They're involved in farming. It's not strictly just crops. But they have less to do. So their seasons are changing. What are they going to go do now? They have food from previous years, maybe some stored up grain. I don't know what they got going on there, but some stuff from previous years. But it's there, but they aren't working for it. What are they going to go do? I'll tell you what most farmers have done that I read about. They go to town, literally. They actually travel from the crops to the town. And what they do in town, they spend money. They buy things. They sell stuff. I know they actually buy and sell things. So does their economic activity die in the seventh year cycle? No, it doesn't. The economic activity changes the seventh year cycle. The economy doesn't actually crash. It changes, it shifts. Things that are active become inactive. Things that were inactive become more active. So it's actually the company just shifts. We think of, I've talked to enough people regarding the banking system, they all flip out if they had a seventh year Shemitah cycle. But I get that, that's their business. But the idea is that the economy doesn't die off. Certain sectors condense, some expand. Now, I ask you, why am I telling you all this? So why does it matter? Well, because God's design, then, it tells us, for resting, both for our bodies as well as for our land, is that we shift what we do from one thing to something different that's not normally done the rest of the time. That is, not focused necessarily on what our routinely chores are, routinely tasks are, to shift them to something that is more interesting, more valuable to us. Now, I say, what's more valuable to us than the farmer crops? Well, farmer crops, when they shift to town work, town life, town visiting, town participation, is that's it. They're participating in the town. They're participating amongst people. They're participating in the community. They're actually making a stronger active participation in the community versus when they're farming. That sounds strange, but they actually are, because they're more connections, they're seeing more people, they're talking with people, they're finding out more things. That's what's happening. It's communication. Much like journalism does for Jeff, the idea is you get information transfer. People get to not be so far away, removed from their towns and villages, that they can actually participate in them. The reverse also happens. The flip side occurs too. Because the farms aren't bringing crops in, and the people of towns have to go get food, and they pick it themselves, where are they going? To the farms. So they get to participate from a town life into a agricultural life. Go harvest it yourself. We essentially are taking two groups of people and for a short period of time, switching places. That's the idea. Not fully, but in part. Yeah, not communist style switching places, but as far as Isaac pointed out, but the actual responsibility switching places. What does it do to a town's purpose? For example, don't raise your hands, but think about it. How many people in that you know in your town, your city, your community are familiar with and have actively participated in slaughtering? Some, yeah. Like slaughtering crops, no, not people, animals. Animals, like for example, chickens or goats or cattle, food. In the towns and cities, a very small percentage, not zero, but a small percentage. Mostly go to the grocery store and buy it. Similarly, in any type of crop or industry, or harvesting grapes, for example, Jeff's in the grape wine reporting business, right? So how many townspeople or city people like to drink the wine, but don't go out there and pick the grapes themselves? Now, obviously some do, but a large percentage of them do not do that. So they may not live near grapes or where they happen to be in their region. The idea is that you've swapped places for a little while. Now, the towns aren't going to go harvest things per se as far as for crops and sell them, but they're still participating in the agricultural community and the business. So the idea is that we've changed people's roles for a little while. And what does that do to the townspeople? They have a better realization, understanding of what it means to be a farmer. They just do, because there's more involvement there. So in this Shabbat, the Shemitah cycle, it's not quite like Shabbat in that it's a true rest of the business. It's or the crops, or like business for Shabbat, we rest from our economic activity almost completely. But the case of Shemitah cycle, there's some similarities, but there's some distinct differences. The Shemitah cycle does not completely eliminate, like Shabbat does, activity. Instead, it more does a morphing and a swapping of places on responsibilities of who does what, which is different. We ask ourselves, well, why does God think this is so important? Why is it so important that that the townspeople should understand or learn more about the idea of farming and farm life? And the farm people should learn more about the idea of towns and town life, because we are a community. We're built of many, not a few. We are participants, and what I do in my town life will affect the farmer, what he does in his farming life, and vice versa. If I am too far removed from the farmer, from the land, from the property of God, I will make myself think or concoct crazy ideas and implement them, possibly to the destruction of my community, which God was very opinionated about destroying the land that he built, he created. So there's some Shemitah cycle similarities for Shabbat and some differences. I bring those up because they affect us in how we view one another. I've never worked as a dental hygienist, right? I understand they have some tools, they scrape and scrape, which some are cool, some are like not my favorite, but they have the various things they do. I will not understand what it's like to be a dental judge. I just won't. I'm not going into business. It is easier, however, for me to understand what's going on with a farmer if I participate in a farming life for a little while. Even if it's only for, you know, a year or 6 months, whatever long, I will understand more about it. See, it says the Soviet Union, I'll have to read this comment here. This is the Soviet Union and communist China tried to force people to work in the fields and farmers to become industrial manufacturers. That was a disaster, right? It doesn't work for very long, does it? But the idea is to understand each other, not to become one another permanently. You don't all of a sudden become, you're now the real farmer versus the other guy. So it doesn't work as a long-term life change, although for some people it might. So our gains are put on suspension when it comes to Shabbat, and our gains are also put on suspension, some gains, for the Shemitah cycle. You also notice, of course, it has a jubilee here being discussed and brought up here on this life cycle. So jubilee has a few differences. Before we leave the Shemitah, though, do recall that debts, like, you know, some debts at least are forgiven. Not necessarily all debts are forgiven, but some debts are forgiven. So in the case of the farming side, the Shemitah cycle has the crops over here, but the no gain side over here when it comes to the Shemitah cycle. They also have debt forgiveness. Debt, BT, thank you. I was about to start department. debt forgiveness. Now we look at, well, this is terrible for banking. Yeah and no. It's yes and it isn't. So the debt forgiveness that does take place on Shemitah cycles is the idea that Joshua, how much money he owes or doesn't owe, is not relevant anymore. We're not going to collect on the past debt. That doesn't mean he can't incur new debt. It just means that the past ones are not going to be active. And we're going to discuss that in a little more detail because it covers the debt. This debt cycle is not a foreign idea in the form of we have interests and was brought up in Matthew 5 as well as in the other New Testament scriptures. So there's a debt cycle and debt interest. So you learned from our Bible, obviously the most notable ones is clearly in the Proverbs of a borrower will say to the lender, right? The various things we have, we learn about what debts and what debts do to people. And the opposite of a righteous person, one of the examples given, is one who lends for profit or for interest. So we understand that the righteous person does not lend for profit or interest. But and debt is also a destructive behavior to us and to our families and our lifestyle. So the idea is a 7-year cycle as far as you forgive debts, which means, or what translates to, you reduce the one of the driving forces to poverty. Not the only force, but one of the driving forces to poverty is debt. Debt will saddle people, right? So in the case of debt forgiveness, we didn't just rest from the land, we also rest from poverty. We're resting from poverty. Now, does that completely eliminate your ability to be poverty stricken? No, it does not. It just diminishes one of the biggest driving forces to poverty, which is debt, how much you owe, how much we expect you to pay. So we're still doing these Shemitah cycle principles. In the case of Shabbat, for example, we don't buy or sell. That includes we don't pay our bills. That sounds strange. We don't pay our bills on Shabbat. We take our bill time is off. We're not buying and selling. We're not paying bills. Even though we may owe money, we don't worry about it for Shabbat. It's only a day, so most businesses don't care. But the case of the Shemitah cycle, the poverty is to be given up. Now, in our banking system, they all go haywire. That could never happen. We couldn't function. No, you can. In our modern banking system, you just have much, much, much smaller short-term loans. That's literally what you do. You have a short-term loan. Okay, your loan is for, let's say there's 3 years of Shemitah cycle. Well, I'll give you a 3-year loan. Right? That's what it's designed for. They have shorter amounts. Yeah, you pay it back before it's due. That's a business would do that. And I say that because banking and taking interest of bank is not against the Bible. And is it? Banks are allowed to earn interest. They're allowed to give loans for interest. You as individual in our Torah are not. That you as a person, when you give somebody a loan, if I give somebody $20, I don't charge them a 1% interest or a 10% interest or whatever it happens to be. I gave them $20. The idea is that you as an individual are not a business. You are a human being. Your brother's a human being. You give them money for whatever they need. You don't worry about the interest owned off it. They may pay it back, but so the interest not designed to pay it. In the case of businesses, which is banking, that's not the case. A business is a business. The parable Jesus gave, obviously, the banker was probably legit. Hey, you should at least put money in a bank to earn interest because banks do business loans. Business to business is not the same as person to person. The Torah was not designed per se in business to business and every business transaction. So from human to human. So the case of businesses, businesses may take longer or shorter loans or have other interest rates they may charge. Businesses is a business. This is not designed for, it was did not discuss business to business transactions. It was person to person transactions. Yes, we may argue, well, isn't a business people too? Business to business is a different thing than human to human, or first person. Let's go to our Jubilee because this is more important. I want to cover more about this because it's far more critical to your personal act life. The reason it's more critical because as you noticed in our American culture, is this currently done? No. Is it going to be done? Probably not. Why not? Because this was very explicit. God said, this is my land. I gave this, that's what you do with my land. And what was that land? Israel. So this Shemitah cycle system and the laying of rest system was designed specifically to the land that God gifted to Israel. Now, so you can apply to the places that wasn't designed for the places, designed for Israel. So I want to bring this up to you because this is really important. So I'm not going to worry so much about these details of Shemitah cycles. You will notice that we as modern day, I guess you call them sustainable agriculture, they call it, whatever the fancy word is, whatever their phrase is. They don't let the crop land rest in the same way that it was done. They cycle it, right? Let me erase some of the stuff here. In our modern day systems, as far as sustainable agriculture is concerned, they do what we call cover crops. So I'm going to make a fake calendar here, right? And this is years 1, 2, 3, 4, da, da, da. They do cover crops. So I may have a year, let's say, for example, I'm a farmer, I grow corn 1 year. Well, the next year, I can't grow corn for 6 straight years because the land would be so horribly depleted, it wouldn't grow anything. So they cycle corn, they do beans, and they back and forth and back to corn, oops. And then bean, every other year. They go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth to try to keep the land nourished. It doesn't actually work very well, but they try. And it buys them a number of years. One of the sustainable agricultural solutions, I'm reading this up for a reason, by the way. I'm not trying to be a farmer. I'm going to explain what's going to happen in Jeremiah 11 explains some of the inherent flaws with this idea. So they do this back and forth, corn, bean. Some sustainable agriculture does a little better the job than that. They have their calendar year. Maybe they do corn for 1 year and then do a useless cover crop like rye. And they're rye on, and they don't harvest it. The rye just sits there. It grows, it does its own thing, they plow it under. They don't do anything with it, they just let a little rye. And then they might grow, for example, then on year 3 of bean. And then another rye crop to bury it under, to not harvest. So they're harvesting every other year, and in between years, they grow essentially grass that doesn't help them anything as far as their livelihood is concerned. That's one of the common things done today. The only time they will leave a land untouched, like truly fallow, like we talk fallow land, is if the area is super dry, I mean, there's very minimal water, doesn't rain much, and it's super depleted, almost like sand. It's turning into sand because it's been so heavily depleted. Then they'll leave it untouched. And the idea is if you try to do a fallow land, right, and left it just untouched, and it was a wet season, wet area where it rained a lot, you will lose all your soil. The rain washes it away. You need something that has lots and lots of roots to hold that land in place if it rains enough. If you leave it fallow, it doesn't do that. It just washes away. You've lost your, you didn't, the land didn't rest. It actually destroyed it instead. not very useful. If you live in a very dry climate, which rarely rains much, the foul thing works perfect. Because you leave it there, it'll just do its thing, not do much, not going to wash away, it does great. So it is still done, but it's done rarely. This is why I bring this up. Who invented the solution? Did God invent the solution? Or did man invent the solution? God invented the fallow solution. Who invented the rotating crop solution? Man did. And do we give rest then to the land if we're rotating crops? No, we're not. So we came up with a better way, right? Because we're so much smarter. Aren't we brilliant? Human beings are so smart. We now know how to do it just right. We do it correctly. No, we don't. We did it our way. What did we do? Replaced an instruction from God with an instruction from a scientific, you know, research lab. Now, it's shocking, isn't it? Replacing God with science. Never thought that would happen, right? But the idea is that we have taken a God-based solution, replaced it. And here's the interesting thing also. You will also note back in the biblical times where there are things known as weed killers. In biblical times, they spray crops with weed killers. They'd pull them by hand. Do you spray bugs with crops with insecticides? No. Why? They didn't have any. So the point is, your crops would not be a pure crop anyway, would they? They mix everything else that's growing naturally. So what is the soil health for the biblical design? Very diverse. All the time. So it's very different than how life would have worked had we done things then. Now, what would happen? We'd probably be much smaller cities, a lot more people working those farms. So that's the extent I want to talk about the Shemitah cycle. If there are any questions, we can discuss it. But this is basically crops. What I want to spend more time on, which is more critical to those of us in the United States, is a Jubilee cycle. Erase my little book or my notes here. Jubilee cycle is still tied to Shemitahs, but to count it a little differently. In the Jubilee cycle, we have obviously our Shemitah cycles, and you get seven of them, which you have the seventh year of no gain, right? And you do that, you know, seven times. This is, we'll do this, we'll put it over here. So we have one, we do it again, three, four, five, six, seven. We do it seven times. So we have all these weeks, right? These years, weeks of years, all the way down. And so you pass the 49th year, which is week seven, and you get number 50. And the number 50 year is its Jubilee cycle year. And some interesting things happen, which we're familiar with. We've read this story before. One of the things that happened, yes, Yosef. Isn't that when the slaves get set free? Right, so they can choose whether they stay or not. So the thing about the slaves being free too, also, the Shemitah cycles also will free some slaves, but not really. So those of you who read the 7 year, so slaves, if you're a Hebrew slave, a Jewish slave, you work for 6 years, seventh year, you're free normally. Now, the seventh year is not the Shemitah year, it's your seventh year. So if you were sold as a slave in year two of a Shemitah cycle, you don't go free at the next Shemitah cycle. You wait till you've reached your seventh year, which would be year, I guess, completion year one, whatever, after the next Shemitah cycle. So your 7 year payment for your personal life is based on when you were enslaved. It's not based on an annual or the communal 7 year sets, right? It's its own unique thing. And I say that because God is very faithful on that concept, because the Jubilee runs that way too. No, it sounds strange, but Jubilee on a national level runs one way, and he also counts Jubilees in totally independent of the national event. So your Jubilee year is when you reach 50, right? Well, is that the Jubilee of the nation? No, it's when you reached 50. It's your year, right? That's for you. The nation may not have reached 50. They should be, in our case, 250 years old. It's not necessarily your Jubilee. It may be, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. It's when you reach 50. When a major event occurs in life, 50 years later, for some of us at least, those major events change or do shifts in our lives. depends on who you are and what the series is. If you wish to read more about that, we can discuss it. Some of the books have articles or documents with these details. What I want to bring to your attention is the Jubilee cycle for you as a person is similar to the Shemitah cycle for you as a person, but it's not the same as the national Shemitah or national Jubilee. It's different. You may be enslaved for some debt or whatever it happens to be, or not debt, like you're enslaved, but for your work, for a job, for example. It could be any year it happened to land on. And your Shemitah cycle, your sabbatical year, those of you in education business, education like as in college professors or the little designs, they get sabbatical year roughly every so many years. So it used to be 7. I'm not sure they still do 7 or not. But it wasn't relevant. Not the entire staff got laid off for a whole year at the same time. It didn't work that way. You, as maybe say, let's present, for example, you're in, because of things I'm familiar with, the engineering field. So you're an engineering professor. And you're working, you're teaching. After so many years, 6 years theoretically, you've taught. Well, now you leave the 7th year to go work in a business, actually in the real field, in real doing real things. It keeps you fresh with actual real life experience. Then you come back and work for those 6 years as a teacher. They don't lay off the entire engineering staff, entire mathematical staff, entire literature staff, the English staff, all scientific staff, all the exact same year the school would shut down. It doesn't do that. See, you get your Shemitah cycle, your sabbatical is based on when you were hired versus when you get your time off. That it still operates that way, at least it did when I was going to school. I assume it still does. The case of a national thing, it doesn't work that way. What's that? You said don't do it anymore? Oh, well, they apparently don't do it anymore. They used to do that. I liked my teachers to do that. They're really good at it. They should do that because they're very useful in the industry field, but maybe it's not work for every field necessarily. The law field would be beneficial too, but that's all right. Law field still does select people. So some industries don't do that, but some used to. But the idea is that your sabbatical is different necessarily than a national sabbatical or a national jubilee, right? It still works that way. The idea was it was supposed to work that way. In the case of jubilees, though, those of you who are more familiar with this than I am will note that they are a 50-year cycle, and it was based on Israel's jubilee. So the last... There's been a few jubilees that we know about, meaning people have tracked down and traced down. Those of you who are very familiar with this has been long since argued for, probably since before I was born. 67 AD is nationally, globally known as one of the jubilee years. Because that was the temple destruction year. That's when the Israel's in Jerusalem was taken down. So 67 AD is known as nationally as a jubilee year. Now I realize modern day Judaism shifted that to 70 AD as its preferred year. Mathematically, actual historical documents prove it was 67. So we've pretty much stuck with 67 AD for at least as far back since before I was probably born. That's been known for its jubilee year. And it has interestingly noted that if we do the simple basic math from 67 AD, I'm going to jump a whole lot of years because it's the last time the historical documentation only goes back so far for history to 1867. 1867, say, well, what's the big deal? 1867, 1800 years go by, right? Long time. A lot of history happens 1800 years. 1867, a huge major event that no one cared about happened. So that was, which so far I've noted like 4 or 5 different religious theologians have discussed this matter and agreed with it. That was the year that Mark Twain. Visited and published his book about Jerusalem. That's a K. Terrible spelling, Mark Twain. It's supposed to be a K. And he fulfilled in his book the most famous passage in Deuteronomy 28 and 29 in that visit, which was once the stranger comes to Jerusalem and says, this is a wasteland. and returns to his home country and proclaims it. It is a wasteland that God has neglected and forgotten and gotten rid of this territory. There's nothing holy about it left because of the corruption that they did. And he said that and wrote it in a book and published it. And once that happened, the entire world shifted. The entire world started to shift toward Jerusalem, and people started to return to Jerusalem in that year onward. And God said, once this happens, once this stranger from a far land does this, I will then have compassion on you and return you to the city. So 1800 years go by from one major event. By the way, they did try a few times between 67 AD and 1800. It always failed. Before people started to return from this year onward. Now, those of you who know your history, since 50 and 50 and 50 and 50, you add them up, you also have your next Jubilee year of 1917. Those of you who know your World War I history, right? That was when Britain took Jerusalem, took Israel. They took it from the Ottoman Empire 50 years later. So you have a 50-year cycle taking place. So we know that God clearly, from historical reasons, is not neglecting the Jubilee cycles. And he has a very, very long memory. 1,800 years, he didn't forget. He's still counting. Whether we may not be, but he's still counting. And those of you, of course, are very familiar. By the way, when Britain took Israel, that's when Israel's people were allowed to legally return more rapidly in massive succession and by the hundreds, if not thousands, in a year. Usually thousands. And of course, we all know 19, I don't write left-handed, forgive me, 67, which is when Israel took Jerusalem in the 67 war, the famous Six-Day War. So we have a sequence of events. We have obviously God is still counting 50-year cycles. And of course, obviously 2017, when the U.S. recognized Jerusalem as a capital of Israel. So all of these events, we can see a pattern of God didn't forget. It's a shock, right? God didn't forget. He didn't forget. So all these years, so in the case of the Jubilee cycle, the years match and they haven't changed. So God's still counting. So I want to point that out to us because it's relevant to our lives. If you want, there's books about this. You want to read more about these books. I won't go through all these books, but the idea of the Jubilee cycle is a restoration sequence that God is still applying, is still doing on a regular basis. I have a hand up. I apologize for ignoring the hand. What's the hand to help? Somebody help? Somebody had a question?
Yes. My question is for Mark Twain there. Where does it say that in the Bible that a stranger came and said the land was desolate?
Deuteronomy 28 and 29. Let me double check. Did I write down the address? Oh, let's see here. I can find my Bible and look it up for you. So the storyline as it goes, Moses is giving his like farewell address, and the tail end of Deuteronomy, and discusses these details. So we have, let's see here, I think it's 29. Let me double check real quick. A nation would say, why is the Lord, verse 24, done to this land? What does the heat of this great anger mean? That men should say, because they have forsaken the covenant of the Lord, their God, their fathers, he has made them, and they made with them Egypt, brought out the land of Egypt. But they went and served other gods and worshiped them, gods that they did not know. They had not given to them. The anger of the Lord was aroused against this land to bring out every curse written in this book. The Lord uprooted them from their land in anger and wrath, and the great indignation has cast them to another land, as it is this day. That phrase means that the nations would look upon them and say, this is a disastrous, destructive place, and God has destroyed them, which he actually, Mark Twain said that in his book, that God caused this.
Well, what destroyed was the this scripture place, again? People.
Oh, that was Deuteronomy 29. All of it? That is from verse, yeah. Let's see, from verse, actually almost the entire, from verse 16 through 29. So Mark Twain fulfilling that verse, that passage is really a big deal within I shouldn't say all modern Christianity, but a lot of modern Christianity discusses this matter being as a turning point within inside of Israel. So there's other things that took place, by the way, these same years where I cover all those details. But the idea is that God was shifting the world in a Jubilee cycle. And it's important to understand that. So God does not ignore his Jubilee cycles. And then that brings the obvious question. If he's not ignoring the Jubilee cycles, does that mean he's not ignoring the Shemitah cycles? The answer would be, yeah, he's not ignoring them either. So if he's not ignoring them, maybe we shouldn't ignore them either. Anne, you had a comment? Go ahead, Anne.
Yes, I don't know whether this is off the subject. This is Jeremiah chapter 11. I read it today, and I'm questioning where's the relevance of that in Jeremiah 11, and also verses 15 and 16 is in the essay form, are put aside or set aside apart from the other narrative. And I'm wondering who's speaking at that in that section there of chapter 11, verse 15 and 16.
In Jeremiah? Yeah, so we're moving to Jeremiah shortly. We'll discuss Jeremiah in a few minutes. So the idea, I want to finish this off before we get there, because Jeremiah is talking. I agree with you, it does appear initially not totally relevant. How does this tie to farming? It's not about the farming thing, or Shemitah cycle, or even Jubilee cycles. Jeremiah brings up a different concept that's being addressed here in this time period. During the time of Leviticus, when we're discussing this, there's a comment or an idea, I should say, that Jeremiah is bringing up. We'll cover that shortly. There are multiple people talking in Jeremiah, meaning he's recording both himself as well as people of Anatoth, as well as God himself. So there's three different voices being discussed in that particular book at the same time. Before we get there, though, I want to finish this one off because we'll cover that shortly. I know I'm already past your time. I started really late. Something happened here. In the case of those of you curious about the interest thing and taking care of people regarding the Jubilee or Shemitah cycle in general, is that the goal being to avoid poverty. Not that you can stop everybody from ever becoming poverty stricken, but to reduce its likelihood of gifting people, giving things back. Israel as a nation, as a people group, not the modern day Israel, but the people group, had not had a homeland. They were poverty stricken, meaning lack of a home, lack of a land for 1800 years. And so God reversed that process and returned them to their inheritance from that point of 1867 onward. The process moved forward. Now, let's go and address Anne's question regarding Jeremiah 11. Jeremiah 11, so those of you who are not familiar with what Jeremiah is dealing with at this point in his book, he started out the book early on when God said, don't worry, no one's going to kill you. They're going to come really close, but no one's going to successfully kill you. They may try, but don't worry, they won't be succeed at it. He's like, yeah, that doesn't sound so great, God. Okay, so I'm not going to necessarily die. Sometimes we may want to die, but he's like, no, 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 you're going to live for this. And Jeremiah's like, bummer, but spare it. So the idea is that in Jeremiah 11, there's some things happening in his book. So he is cursing Judah because Judah has cursed God. The Lord replaced him. Imagine before, I talked about the fact that we had science replace our God's cycle for Shemitahs and how to take care of crops and how smart we are, how great, how more superior we are to God as a result. Well, Jeremiah's people in his day had their own ideas also, not based upon crops necessarily, based upon their idea of what God was or wasn't. And so they had replaced him. And Jeremiah 27 covers this extensive thoughts in the case of when you replace God, you will get cursed, period. He will extract his blessings from you and you'll be left alone and destitute, which is what happened with Jerusalem. Not just for crops, but other reasons too. They replaced God and thought they were smarter. Hence, as I mentioned before, the 1800 years they had to wait to get back to land again, they had replaced God. He wasn't their primary concern. So God said, well, I'm going to take the land away from you. So it's not terribly shocking in Jeremiah 11 when that's what's happening here in this story. The idea of replacing God with your own knowledge, your own wisdom, your own intelligence is not going to succeed. That replacement will result in your cursing. And Jeremiah, obviously, as the first half of his chapter, curses them because of it. And he's reciting to God, saying, hey, you have as many cities you do, you have gods as the number of cities you have. Go worship, go call them when you have troubles, don't call me. And God specifically states in verse 15 and 16, as and quickly pointed out, verse 14 says, therefore, he's talking to Jeremiah and anybody who's listening to him. Verse 14 says, do not pray for this people or lift up a cry of prayer for them. I will not hear them in the time that they cry out to me because they're trouble. So he's telling Jeremiah, don't bother praying. I'm not going to listen. That's pretty bad. When you've reached a point, your corruption of your lifestyle and way of life, that when you pray to God, he's plugging his ears as if you are not saying anything, as you're not speaking, you've gone pretty darn low. That's pretty much the bottom end. It's lower than your rock bottom. It's his rock bottom. That's pretty bad. Okay. God has pulled you out of a lot of things, but when you've reached your rock bottom and he's still listening, you haven't reached his rock bottom. When you've reached his rock bottom, he stops listening. That's really, really low. I can't quite imagine what that lowness is other than what I could describe here. They basically replaced him, but it is you replace God. You've reached God's rock bottom. He has no use to speak or listen to you anymore. And the people of Jeremiah's day, this is what they did. They replaced God with their own way of life, their own God. So in the case of this comment, says, don't pray, don't listen. And it says, verse 15, what has my beloved to do in my house, having done lewd deeds with many, and the holy flesh, this is a King James Version, or New King James Version, holy flesh has passed from you. When you do evil, then you rejoice. The Lord called your name a green olive tree and a lovely and a good fruit. With the noise of a great tumult, he has kindled a fire on it and its branches are broken. So you've reached God's rock bottom. He has no longer much of a use for you because he's not listening to you anyway. So at this point in time, when you've replaced him, he's not going to respond. And that's where the bottom line is. When it comes to the Shemitah cycle and the Jubilee cycle, if we ignore them, pretend they don't happen, they don't matter, God doesn't care, what have we done? Well, since we replaced God. We told him it doesn't matter. It's just not relevant. Our own wisdom is more relevant than his. Our own way is superior to his. That's the inherent flaw. Now, in this, Jeremiah was not finished. You will also note that in some of these passages, we have a conspiracy. So Jeremiah had prophesied against his own personal family. So those who don't remember Jeremiah's story, earlier on in the book, chapter 2, I think it is, God tells him that to go inquire and who knows God, who doesn't know God. And he found in Jerusalem, pretty much nobody knew who God was. They were all confused at what he was and wasn't. Only people in charge, the nobles, the princes, actually knew who God was, but didn't obey him. And God said, yep, they don't know me, and I'm not happy with them, and I'm not going to hear their prayers anymore. Well, Anatoth is a Levitical city that the priests from, I forgot the high priest's name. You know, in the time of David, he had multiple priests. Eli's descendants. So Eli with his two sons, I forgot their names. The two dead. They both were killed anyway. They weren't very, very great kids. Anyway, so two sons, his line was divided. His line grew and continued on to live, but they were essentially banished or sent off the town of Anatoth. So his family line, the high priests from Eli, were sent to Anatoth. They got replaced by Zadok's family. So Anatoth is mostly, but not wholly, mostly the hometown of the people from Eli's line, you know, when Samuel and Hannah and such were alive. That's his town. So Jeremiah is from that town, was born there. We don't know if he was biologically related to Eli or not. We do know, however, he was born and raised in that town. And one of the priests, which is his own dad, of that town, conspired to kill him. I can't imagine a father conspiring to kill his son because his son was telling the family and the people that they're not obeying God and the solution was to execute him. It seems really far and bizarre to me. But apparently in the men of Anatoth, that was not the case. they were not upset with the idea of executing Jeremiah and killing him off. So this was a conspiracy that he said, hey, I was totally tricked and didn't know they were going to kill me off. And he says, God, you repay them. God, make this not happen. And God says, don't worry, they're not going to kill you. And matter of fact, they're all going to die. They die a very horrible existence, and I'm going to exterminate them and their families for this. So again, what did they do? They were so upset with God's way of life and the condemnation about what they were doing that they decided the best way is to kill the messenger. Because that always works, right? If you kill the messenger, then it doesn't going to happen, right? No, that doesn't work that way. Yeah, he's going to do it anyway. The sender of the message is going to kill you anyway. Just because you kill the messenger doesn't make the message go away. It just means it happens in spite of killing the messenger. So the idea is they would kill the messenger off, Jeremiah in this case, because they wanted to replace God with their own way of life. And Jeremiah is saying, you guys know better. They say, we don't care. And that's really what it boils down to. How it ties to Shemitah or Jubilee cycles is the same concept. It's not explicitly described, but it's the same concept of replacing God's way with your way. The last connection you have with Jeremiah, or the last one, but one of the primary connections you have with Jeremiah is Jeremiah obviously prophesies the 70 years in exile for the lack of the Jubilee rest years that Israel, the Shemitah years that Israel did not obey. So there's a lot of connections there for Jeremiah in general, but the idea is that replacing God with your way of life, with your knowledge, your wisdom, your whatevers, does not fix it. Does not make it go away. Does not make God say, oh, I'm so sorry. You were smarter than me. You figured it out. Forget me. You have a better way. I didn't know. It doesn't work that way. God is still God. And that's the idea being applied here. I don't know if that makes any sense, but that's a connection with Jeremiah 11. I am way over time because I started late, so I'm not going to push any further necessarily. If you are curious or interested about the lending process and wickedness associated with that, Ezekiel 18 discusses that when it comes to Shemitahs and lending people with interest. Also, Luke 6 talks about that too, that we lend people for the Shemitah cycles. This is personal loan. Person A to person B, we're not talking business loans, that when you charge interest, you are categorizing yourself with the wicked people. And I'll put this out to those who are not, I want to end with this thought process, okay? Just think about this for a minute. A person is a pretty bad person in life. They do good things and bad things, and overall, they can be pretty rotten, right? And regardless of what they think, oh, there's a God, maybe there is, maybe there's not, I'm not sure, maybe they could be, I'll think about it, wishy-washy. All those things, I don't know if we realize this, but if that person then says, hey, I'm wealthy, I have lots of money, I have lots of stuff, I'm going to start giving all my stuff away. Just give my money away. Those who need it, just give it away. Give and give and give and give and give. May not say to poverty stricken themselves, but poor enough because they're dying anyway. No one lives forever. And giving it all away. We may argue how a horrible person they once were, how awful they treated so-and-so, how terrible they were for this and that other thing. When they're being generous and just donating all the wealth they gained and just giving and giving and giving and giving, what does that do to our theological or our viewpoint of that individual? It changes. Like it or not, it changes. So, wow, that person just is, they spent all these years gaining and now they quit gaining. They're just giving. It shifts. It shifts our thought process of them. When they become old, maybe they're 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, whatever, and they're just giving away to everything. They had no use for it themselves. They're not trying to gain anymore. Not notoriety, not fame, just give and get rid of. God does not ignore that. We may not like it. Well, I was a horrible human being. How dare he? We can say what we want. But remember Ezekiel 18, when God says, if you change from your evil ways and you shift from all the bad things you did and shift to righteousness, it's as if those evil things never happened. That is our God. Interesting character. Interesting character. Rose, you have a comment?
Yeah, just on a funny note here. I'm one of those that have gathered and gathered and gathered. And I'm ready to give it away now because I found out recently that there's no moving van behind the Hearst. Can't take it with me, so it's time to let go.
Because it's actually any good anyway, where you're going. It's a really important principle to think about. There are things we can do to try to fix our lives. Hey, I'll stop doing bad stuff, which is all good. That's important to do. You just stop being a corrupt human being. But the idea is that how much you can, or a human being can repair, according to Ezekiel 18's description, you can repair by giving stuff off. And obviously stop the gaining behavior, stop the misuse behavior, the thing that got you the destruction to begin with. But stopping alone is not going to fix it. You can't unring a bell. It's already been rung. You've already done things you can't undo. But by being generous and giving away and not self-gaining anything anymore, you can change, according to Ezekiel's comments, you can change your future. Jesus also said to the rich young man, right? You've done all these things as Moses said. Yeah, I've done everything. Okay, now give yourself away. He couldn't do it. Because he had too much to give. I've acquired these things. I couldn't give away. Don't bring the necks of the dumbbells. So the principle behind giving away, you as a human being can do a lot in making storehouse of treasure into heaven. Hence the Shemitah cycle principle, the Jubilee principle, the restoring and just giving what you have. Hey, I don't need this. You can use it. How many of us need $1 million a year to survive? No one. Okay, I'm not saying you can't earn it. The point is, it's not a need. Yeah, I'm sure you can spend a lot of money on those things and whatever you're going to buy, but you can also give it away too. Because you're not using it. You can't eat the stuff. It's whether paper, whether it's metal, it made a difference, or plastic in Israel's case. Whatever it is, it's not of no real value to you. Giving away doesn't hurt you. You're not in some desperate financial straits by losing lots and lots of money when you already have a lot. The point is that giving away helps those who, I'm not a socialist or communist. The point is it's by voluntarily gift, not by forced law. That is, you can give away, you can change your status, your position, your life in heaven. By not undoing, but by helping to pay for and bless those that are less fortunate than you have been, if that makes any sense. It's not a common thing we spend a whole lot of time discussing necessarily, but God is interested in the common wealth of everyone, not just you, not just your friends or family, your business. Everyone's common wealth, a common value to the people and nation you live in matters. Hence why a Shemitah cycle exists, where debts are returned or are forgiven, where people get their rest. Why a Jubilee exists, to restore what was once yours that you may have lost for whatever reason, to give you a break from the burdens you're under. That's what exists, to give us that rest. And if we give away the excess we have, well, that's a blessing to some who are receiving it. I don't know how many people receive it, it made a difference, but it's a blessing is that you're giving them rest from their burdens too. Whether it's a charity, whether it's a poor person, whatever the case may be, you're helping them rest. When Jesus healed people from the sick, whether they're sick to the ailments, right? He was giving them rest from their sicknesses, from their misery, from their hardness, from their sorrows, from their heartbreaks. Right? You give them rest and they're at peace. Those are blessings. God's really big about avoiding destructive behavior or things that could hurt you as a person. So we help others, and then that's where our treasure in heaven continue to grow. Any comments, questions? I took you over time. I apologize for that. There are some sections I missed on commentary because I didn't have time to cover them, but hopefully it makes some sense as far as we covered today. Tammy's a comment. Go ahead, Tammy.
I would just summarize it this way. It's a good thing to work hard, but not to work yourself to death. It's good that the land will produce for us and work hard, but we don't want to work the soil to death. So these rest periods, the Shabbat,
the sabbatical year, these jubilees, whatnot, these are times of rest. So when we work, we need to work hard, but we also need to rest. So then God has planned all this. And it's a pity that the people of Israel didn't follow through with it. Things would have been a lot different. Maybe Mark Twain wouldn't have witnessed what he witnessed in 1867. Because I was reading through his whole thing. He did this whole tour. He went to the Azores and he went to all these different places. And he ends up in the Holy Land. And he was depressed.
It was horrible.
You read that book. It's called Innocence Abroad. If you're interested in reading it, you can find it free online on some of the public libraries like University of Virginia or whatever have it. And you will be depressed. But, yeah. You know, as you were saying here with this, when you're going through some of these dates or whatever, God changed that too. So, yeah, it became a desolation, but he also has now made it a wonder.
Amazing wonder, a crazy, not necessarily like a wonder of the world, but near to it. It's got some serious shifts, and now it's one of the massive producing nations in the Middle East of food crops. Totally different. And essentially, that's what happened. You Mark Twain, in my viewpoint, because the timing was so perfect, triggered that event. God's waiting for this guy, some guy. Of course, Mark Twain's really is Samuel Clemens, which is a Jewish name, but and also a Christian name. But some guy to come along and shift and change the future of Israel. And essentially, that's what he's waiting for. And he made it happen, which Mark Twain's an amazing man for a lot of reasons, but that's one of his crowning achievements, I think, of that book he wrote, in my opinion. He didn't live to see it. He died, but sorry, that's all right. Yeah. If he had lived to see the shift in Israel and see what God did, would have probably shifted his viewpoint on God completely. Because he was like, yeah, who's a God? Who needs that? But not knowing that's a true stranger. I mean, true stranger who doesn't know God, doesn't care about God, doesn't think God really exists. That is a stranger. Not only Israel, it's a stranger to God himself. That's a true stranger. And yet God used him to change the course of Israel's existence, which is pretty cool.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info, hallel.info.